Ame would have died in the tunnel like the idiot he is. I swear to you by all the underground gods that it was Pike who must have talked Ame into taking his clan out onto the steps before the Horde came.
That was a surprise. You think?
Absolutely.
Anybody else think so?
Lots of people.
But Laosh, I began, but Krim interrupted me.
Laosh.
He sneered.
He can't see anything beyond his own nose. Had it not been for you, the Red Owls would have long been dead. All of us.
Well, the clan owes its survival to lots of people, and not just me.
Aha! You see? Your modesty is a sign of wisdom.
Your words are pleasing to my ear, my friend. But still, you're mistaken. Modesty's got nothing to do with it. A clan is like a human body which can't live without its organs. Its heart, liver, or kidneys must work in sync like a single mechanism. Otherwise, the body will die. But I agree with what you said about good leadership. A lot of things depend upon it.
Exactly,
Krim said, rising from his place.
Ame would have never plucked up enough courage to take his people onto the steps.
His last words concerning Pike and Ame were the missing piece of the puzzle I'd so desperately tried to put together for the last few days. I looked around me, searching for Pike. There he was, standing behind Ame, who was sitting on a rock. The old man stood cross-armed, cold and impassive like a block of ice, keeping his eyes peeled for any more blunders from his young leader. I watched Krim's broad back as he left. Then I returned to the business at hand and pressed the backpack's flashing icon. I probably had some more stat points that required distribution. Or did I have 100% knowledge? I really needed to spend a few moments sorting that out. When I saw the reason for the icon's impatient blinking, I didn't believe my eyes. I even rubbed them. My heart missed a beat, freezing in my chest like a scared rabbit. My lips stretched in an idiotic smile. Finally, the icon of the Twilight Castle map was finally active. I thought it would never happen. I remembered that night in the footworn Traveler's Inn when I'd first opened Pierrot's app, which had scared me out of my mind. Then, all those maps, plans, and schemes had felt like something way out of my reach, an impossible dream. And now I was standing here, right in the middle of a giant mushroom field, a pace away from a new discovery. I opened the map with bated breath. A bright red mark glowed at its center. The armory. My back erupted in cold sweat. Was it really possible? Those of the Chaldeans busy by the opposite wall began shouting. I looked up. Droy was running toward me. I rushed to meet him. Only when I came closer did I see his happy, grinning face.
"We've found another door!"
he shouted from a distance.
"The underground gods seem to like you, Keeper."
The rock walls of the armory exuded warmth and calm. The room was dry and even felt cozy in the torchlight. Then again, it could be my Ennin nature. I always felt safe and cozy these days whenever I was down a rock hole. The torches cast their orange light on the Chaldeans' long faces and dropped jaws. Some of them looked quite funny. Their eyes glowed with the anticipation of more loot. Like impatient youngsters, they waited for me to give them the signal to strip the place bare. The door into the armory looked identical to the grotto's front door back on the surface overhead. I'd already made some calculations. A loaded cart, pulled by two buffaloes, could easily go through the tunnel. The room itself was big enough for such a cart to turn round, and I was probably seeing only a small part of it within the torchlight's reach. When we just opened the door, the familiar smell of steel, wood, and oil had hit my nostrils. The room was lined with shelves stacked high with all sorts of boxes and crates. I could see large barrels, iron-bound wooden chests, and bolts of fabric and leather. A wide table by the door was crowded with all kinds of precious boxes.
"So what do you think, Keeper?"
Droy whispered impatiently into my ear.
"You need to make up your mind. Everybody's waiting."
I forced my gaze away from the scene and rubbed my eyes again. Then I smiled to everyone. "Should we share the spoils?" A shattering "Yah!" flooded over me. Seeing as both the grotto and the armory were now the Red Owl's rightful property, we decided to leave our loot here. Now, Droy and I watched the wolves file out of the grotto, ant-like, loaded with a maize share.
"I still think that a quarter of the loot is too much for them,"
Droy grumbled. "That's all right.
These so-called warriors didn't deserve one-tenth of it. We did all the work."
"They lost 13 dead, you know."
"That's another thing,"
he complained.
"Why did you have to give anything to the families of the dead? What's it called now?
Compensation, I offered.
"Exactly. That's what I meant, damn it. It's the clan's leader's duty to make provision for them."
I locked his gaze with mine. "You're right, my friend. A clan leader is obliged to take care of his warriors and their families." Frowning, he gave me a long look. Gradually, his face cleared as he began to realize what I'd meant.
"Do you mean to say that the wolves..."
"Why not? I can't see what's stopping it." My confidence in our future merger had been born the moment I'd received the little green medal certifying my reputation with the Northern Wolves. Let them help themselves to as much loot as they can carry. Sooner or later, they were going to join our ranks anyway. And as for the loot, most of the items we'd found in the armory were blue anyway. All the materials, all the leather, wood, metals, and stones were marked as rare and came with craftsmanship restrictions. Neither the Red Owls nor the wolves could use any of it yet. By the time the wolves would be able to craft something out of the steel they were now so excitedly carrying toward the grotto exit, we'd have already become a united clan. In fact, I could have offered Amay to have left their share in the grotto, in our safekeeping, so to say. That would have saved them a lot of time. Still, on second thought, I'd decided against it. They might have thought we were trying to rob them of their share. Until the last moment, they'd believed we weren't going to give them anything. Interestingly, once I'd failed to live up to those expectations by sharing the loot with them, my relationship with Pike had grown to trust. Not bad. Strangely enough, everybody had ignored all the precious chests and boxes sitting on the table. It was as if NPCs simply couldn't see them. Apparently, this was what the system considered my personal share. And they were actually quite interesting. A few of the boxes contained all kinds of reputation stones. Three of the chests were absolutely packed with all sorts of potions and elixirs, plus five more chests which contained 3,000 gold each. I must have been dreaming. Let me be completely honest with you. As I watched the Chaldeans fuss around collecting the loot, all sorts of funny thoughts entered my head. Like that I could appropriate everything without having to share it with anyone. I'd even made a quick estimation of what it might fetch me at auction. The answer was a lot. Still, my other self, the one which was normally kind, honest, and level-headed, had ultimately gained the upper hand. According to its reasoning, it was nowhere near enough to pay off my loan, so I wouldn't be gaining that much, really. But I'd be losing quite a lot. I'd lose the Chaldeans' trust, and without them, I'd never be able to keep the Ennin City. But that wasn't all. Everything I'd just mentioned, all the materials, reputation stones, and even gold, paled into insignificance compared to what we'd discovered in the far corner of the armory. We'd found several dismantled Ennin war machines and their blueprints. Chapter 15. Amay's nervousness apart, our farewell from the wolves was cordial. Logical, really, considering they were our comrades in arms. We'd fought side by side. We'd eaten together by the fire. We'd defended each other. We'd shared the loot. We'd become brothers, which was worth a lot to all of us. Amay was decidedly ill at ease watching this. He must have sensed the affinity his elite warriors felt to me. His own authority was plummeting. Pike was the one who still kept his clan together. As I watched the wolves ride into the sunset, I had a funny feeling they'd become part of us one day, just as I'd predicted. Still, I had no time to indulge in musings. We had work to do. Lots of it. We counted 10 long, massive crates packed with machine parts, plus 7 glaive throwers and 3 stone mortars. At least, that's what the blueprints, located in one of the boxes, said. There were quite a few scrolls there, even though I'd only managed to read 2 of them. The rest were, for now, out of my competence. The news of the Ennin machine soon spread around the camp. Everybody came running to take a look at the wondrous things. Warriors and craftsmen, women and old men, and, naturally, the omnipresent kids. Master Pretus, our expert gunner, was especially excited. Thanks to him, we managed to find enough carts to transport our precious cargo. Admittedly, lots of people had come to take part in the action. Without even discussing it, we unanimously started putting a stone mortar together. Why? No idea. Probably because all the numerous parts made it appear much more powerful than a glaive thrower. We must have subconsciously wished for something big and powerful enough to assure us of our security. According to the blueprints, in order to install the mortars, referred to as brocks, we first needed to build a 30-degree ramp. A group of diggers were already busy shoveling, while the others opened the crates and laid all the parts on the ground. I read the lengthy blueprint. As it turned out, The Brock's inventor was none other than my very own Master Grilby, my first mentor, who died in my arms. What's more, it looked like this invention had been the reason why the Ennin race had been destroyed, and all the Black Grisons exterminated. My heart clenched when I thought of the old man. Of course, he was only an NPC, a lifeless piece of program code, but the memories of our meetings were still more than alive. Pretus stood next to me, staring blankly but reverentially at the blueprint. To him, of course, this was all gobbledygook. Shame. I'd have loved to delegate to him all the dirty work assembling it. No such luck, apparently. I'd have to do it myself. As my doctor used to say, a good beginning is half the battle. The voice of one of Pretus's assistants distracted us from the blueprints.
It's all done. The ramp is compacted.
I looked at the small clearing, littered with all sorts of machine parts. All those levers, pulleys, and cogwheels. It was about 30 feet away from the wall. Should be enough for a backswing. If it wasn't, we could always make another ramp. Let's do it, I told Pretus, crouching next to the array of steel junk. With an impatient nod, he squatted next to me. Now, I said, studying the parts, gleaming in the winter sun. I'd like to ask you, Master, to note these symbols which cover each element.
These are runes, if I'm not mistaken,
Pretus replied. Exactly, I said. Have you seen them before? He moved undecidedly closer and spent some time peering at the fancy, swirling symbols. His eyes opened wider. Beads of perspiration covered his forehead. I couldn't take my eyes away from the runes either. They intertwined like the branches on a grapevine, creating a design which was both beautiful and cryptic. The unknown master had wound it all around the steel parts. Now the ornamental chain of symbols was silently speaking to us, whispering its secrets to our hearts. Amazing. With a deep sigh, Pretus forced his gaze away from the array.
I'm sorry, he said, rubbing his eyes. I've never seen this language before. The ancient rune-makers guarded their secrets closely.
He shook his head with regret.
I can't read them.
Never mind. We still had to do it. But first, we had to do one other thing. The blueprint says that each piece is numbered, I told Pretus. Apparently, the numbers denote the assembly order. He immediately knew what I meant.
In which case, we need to lay them out in numerical order. That might make the assembly much easier.
We spent a few more minutes sorting the pieces out by number. Finally, I could start the assembly process. I lay my hand on a small block of steel marked with a tiny number 1 in its top right corner. Warning! You're about to activate Brock Part Number 1. Energy required, 1,000 points. Accept? Yes? No? How very interesting. Under Pretus's surprised stare, I reached into my pocket for an elixir and activated a purple stamina stone. Now we could do it. I pressed accept. For a while, nothing happened. The runes remained gray and lifeless. Then my right hand sensed a pulsating warmth coming from the runes, as if something was trying to break free from its invisible fetters. The small gray pattern began to fill with a dull blue glow that grew brighter with every moment, like a ripening piece of fruit. It was going nicely. Unhurriedly, the ancient artifact continued to siphon my energy. Devoured by the glowing light, the runic patterns turned an intense blue. I couldn't take my eyes away from the wondrous spectacle. I cast a sideways glance at Pretus. He too seemed transfixed, admiring the process. The other Chaldeans crowded around us in silence, taking in the beautiful performance. "Congratulations! You've activated Brock Part Number 1." I turned away from our bewitched audience, looking for the next piece. Ever watchful, Pretus snapped a quick order. His assistants brought us the next part. I smiled to him. "Let's do it." "Warning, you're about to activate Brock Part Number 2. Energy required, 1,000 points. Accept? Yes? No?" "Yes, absolutely." The crowd gasped as the second piece glowed with blue light. "Congratulations! You've activated Brock Parts Numbers 1 and 2. You can now assemble Brock Parts Numbers 1 and 2. Energy required, 200 points. Accept? Yes? No?" This didn't look so exhausting after all. "Yes, why not? And now, part number 3, and number 4, and so on and so forth." Levers, pulleys, and cogwheels followed one after the other. Despite all the stamina stones and elixirs, I soon felt paralyzed with exhaustion. My temples were throbbing. Both my neck and the small of my back were in agony. I felt like a 100-year-old who'd never once taken rest in his lifetime. But the insatiable runes kept demanding more and more energy. When you're busy doing some boring, monotonous task, your mind starts looking for distractions. Usually music helps, as does focusing on the end result, providing the energy necessary for one final push. For me, the actual assembly process offered the necessary distraction. It required less energy and allowed me a quick break to catch my breath and take a look at the emerging machine. Each part had its own unique design, contributing to all the others like puzzle pieces contribute to the resulting picture. But even as the runic patterns linked in perfect harmony, with every part added to the emerging device, it looked more and more clumsy and misshapen. Gradually, the curious crowd of onlookers got bored and disappointed. They began cracking jokes and offering sarcastic advice. I couldn't blame them. Finally, I added the last piece to the runic puzzle, then slumped to the ground, feeling completely drained. "Congratulations! You've built a Brock, an Ennin siege machine. Reward, plus 350 to your craftsmanship." I wiped my sleeve across my forehead, mopping up the sweat, then checked my life stats. I seemed to be okay. What a job. I still had 9 more machines to build. The good news was that glaive throwers had fewer parts.
"Couldn't you make it uglier?"
I turned to the sound and saw Droy's boots standing next to me. "That's the best I could do." The shapeless, steel monstrosity towered on the ramp, its runic nodes pulsating with a sapphire glow.
"How does it work?"
Droy's voice rang with doubt. Grunting like an old man, I scrambled to my feet and stepped toward the weird contraption. "Warning! The Brock is in sleep mode. Would you like to load it? Yes? No?" "Yes, I would." The machine began to vibrate. The runic script glowed brighter. The Brock actually appeared happy to see me. For a brief second, nothing happened. Then the shapeless mechanism shuddered to life. All the blocks, cogwheels, steel bars, and strips of metal came into motion, vibrating and expanding. The amorphous lump of steel began to grow, gaining shape and purpose with every heartbeat. We stood open-mouthed, unwilling to move, as this illogical and meaningless collection of unrelated parts transformed into a monstrous creature. The runic script wound around its powerful body. The steel bars had become its six limbs, four spidery legs, and two arms which ended in large digging buckets.
"I'm taking my words back," Droy croaked. "He's even uglier than I thought."
I drew my gaze away from this amazing creation of ancient masters and turned to him. Droy stood open-mouthed, gawking at the steel monster. His face betrayed the same emotions that I read in the Chaldean's expressions all around me, a mixture of fear and respectful awe. Droy cleared his throat, breaking the deadly silence.
"Impressive. What can it do?"
"One moment," I said, opening the Brock settings. Oh, wow. Its stats were something else. In brief, what we had here was a miracle of top durability with a range of 1,000 feet. More even, dealing enormous blanket damage. Its rate of fire said nothing to me. Still, I had a feeling that somehow it was going to be much faster than Chaldean trebuchets. Its launching mechanism somehow resembled my good old slingshot. Most likely, all of these stats directly depended upon the weight, size, and quality of the missiles used. I looked up from the stats. Should we try it?
"Bring us some rocks!" Droy thundered.
Two warriors promptly dragged a large boulder toward the Brock's right shovel. They swung it several times until they managed to lay it in the machine's open hand. As soon as the boulder dropped inside the shovel, the giant effortlessly raised his arm, as if taking a swing. And then he stopped. "The Brock is loaded. Type of missile, a rock. Fit for purpose? Yes. Range, plus 1,000 feet. Rate of fire, plus 0.02. Blanket damage, plus 18,000 to plus 26,000. A shiver ran down my spine. If a rock like that landed on my group, we were toast. I'd go directly to my respawn point and my clanmates to visit whatever gods they worshipped. "The Brock is ready for action. Energy required to launch a missile, 250 points. Would you like to continue? Yes? No?"
No, wait. This wasn't good.
I didn't mean the energy requirements. I could live with that. The problem was, this machine needed me to activate it. It had even offered me a synchronization option, similar to the one I had with my two pets, but I'd refused it point blank. This thing would bleed me dry like an energy vampire.
"Are you ready?"
Droy asked. I nodded. "Yes."
"So what are we waiting for?"
Instead of an answer, I pressed yes. The Brock's giant arms swung back like a steel spring, devouring the energy offered to it, and launched the huge boulder into the air. Rotating slowly, the rock winged its way toward the center of the valley. A few seconds later, a giant snowflower blossomed on impact. From our vantage point, it looked unpresuming, even pretty. But all of us seemed to realize the nature of its destructive beauty. Then the crowd exploded in catcalls and cheers. What could I say? I, too, threw my hands in the air, screaming with joy. We'd just received a very hefty argument in any potential confrontation. It towered like an impassive cliff of steel over the tiny sentient animals scattered at its feet, its very shape granting us some hope of survival. Chapter 16. For the next 2 days, all I did was assemble Enon machines. I'd used up almost all of my elixirs and energy stones. Still, it was worth it. We had new sentries guarding our rapidly growing town wall now. 3 giant Brocks, 7 glaive throwers, and the Chaldean's trebuchet, which looked admittedly ancient next to the Enon wonders. Earlier this evening, I'd given myself a 3-hour break, after which I'd assembled the remaining glaive thrower. Admittedly, I'd already gotten the hang of it. After the 3 Brocks, assembling glaive throwers was a breeze. In total, I'd spent about 2,000 points energy on each one. I couldn't help smiling whenever I remembered my attempts to assemble the first glaive thrower. Just like the Brock, it had resembled a shapeless heap of haphazardly connected parts. But once activated, it had turned out to be a harpoon gun on a tall steel tripod. Each machine came with a chestful of steel bolts, packed into 20-round clips. Their faceted tips were made of some hard black metal, which, however, looked chewed, almost as if something had gnawed on it. When I took a closer look, I realized that the tips had been completely covered in complex runic patterns. The glaive thrower's principle was considerably different from that of the Brock. The latter was easy. You just filled its Herculean shovel full of rocks and pointed it in the right direction. The downside of it was, I was the only person who could control it. The glaive throwers were different. They didn't need me to issue orders. As soon as they received their share of energy, any of Predis's assistants could pull the trigger. However, the Brocks didn't have a power accumulator, something that glaive throwers had, even though their charges were only enough to fire 1 clip, which was better than nothing, I suppose. So all of the Enon machines required my assistance in one way or another, which wasn't a good thing. The moment we had a war on our hands, these contraptions would suck me dry of energy. My intention had been to assemble all the machines first and then get some practice in. I didn't want to spread myself too thin. So now, the entire clan had gathered around me in anticipation of a new spectacle. Honestly speaking, I'd hoped to get some sleep and test the machines in the morning. But the expectation on all the beaming Chaldean faces had made me reconsider. I told them to make some targets to test-fire our new weapons. They fashioned a dozen dummies stuffed with straw and clad them in some old armor. Then they placed a shield in front of each one and jammed helmets on their heads. It wasn't bad at all. They carried the straw warriors out to a distance of about 500 feet from the wall. The dummies looked seriously militant from afar. I set the firing mode to single shot and took aim. Holding my breath, I used both my hands to pull the firing lever at the back. The recoil was impressive. I physically sensed the machine release the accumulated energy. The bolt hit the exact center of the shield held by one of the dummies. I hadn't expected to see what happened next. The dummy disintegrated. Straw flew everywhere. The crowd gasped.
"Great shot," Droy said an hour later, turning a mangled piece of steel in his hands.
That was all that was left of the shield.
"How is it possible?"
Orman asked, warily studying the glaive thrower. "Take a look at the bolt tips," I said. "They're covered in runes. I think they make the tip disintegrate on impact, turning it into shrapnel." I knew it for sure. After all, I'd read the description.
"And that was just one bolt," Krim said, his eyes gleaming. "But if you fired several at once, simultaneously..."
Everyone hummed their agreement. Even I was suitably impressed. A short burst of 7 bolts made quick work of our DIY army. Their straw bodies exploded like a 10-ton bomb.
"Can't wait to see what they're gonna do to the Noctians,"
Orman hissed predatorily. I sighed. "I'm afraid very soon you might get the opportunity to find out."
"The magic sphere is about to expire," Droy added, looking grim.
The long call of the Red Owl's bugle drowned out our voices. What now? We hurried to climb the wooden scaffolding surrounding the city wall. Our builders hadn't wasted their time. The wall kept growing, surprisingly quickly. Very soon it would reach 7 feet. No wonder. This was a game, after all. Everything that happened here seemed to take place in fast forward. Also, I'd made sure that all of my workers had already made their next level in craftsmanship. We'd decided to build the new wall on top of the old ruins. That way, at least we saved on the foundations. Also, once we'd cleared the ruins from the snow, we discovered whole surviving sections of the wall that were at least 12 feet high. The wall formed a semicircle, which linked 2 impregnable cliff ridges. It looked as if they'd just grown there, gray and grim, obeying the wave of an invisible hand. Their impenetrable embrace protected the upper city, which had once been home to the king and his entourage. We had no shortage of building materials, that's for sure. Ruins were everywhere. Flooded with the light of hundreds of torches, the building site seethed like a giant anthill where everyone was busy doing his or her task. The air rang with the constant tapping of hammers, the screeching of pulleys, and the hacking of axes. Buffaloes bellowed. Builders yelled over each other's heads. Children laughed and ran around. Yes, this was the Chaldeans making themselves a new home. And they didn't look too eager to give it up lightly. The sentries who'd raised the alarm already awaited us on a large platform. I used the chance to inspect it, knowing it was about to become one of our towers pretty soon. We might actually lift one of the glaive throwers up here tomorrow morning. We could install another in the East Tower and place the remaining ones along the wall's perimeter. Not mentioning the brocks, which already line the wall. We kept growing. I honestly hadn't expected such rapid changes. Initially, our situation had been a little less than hopeless, but that was because I used to look at the city ruins from a real-world perspective. I should have been thinking as a gamer right from the start. Things would have been dramatically different in real life. Naturally, we were no match for the player's army. Not yet. We still had plenty of weak points. For one, our impregnable fortress could use a gate. A proper one, I mean. Not the sorry excuse which currently plugged the only access in the breached wall. Which was basically several carts and wagons reinforced with some planks and crude logs nailed together.
"What's up?" Droy asked the sentries.
"Over there!"
A stocky, red-bearded Kaltean pointed south.
"Can you see?"
"What the heck?"
Orman uttered.
"What's that, a river of fire?"
I peered in the direction they pointed. The sun had long set, but the sky was still clear. The large disk of the moon cast a bright light onto the valley and part of the hills. A snaking line of twinkling lights was crossing the valley. Orman had a point. It did resemble a river of fire moving toward us.
"Nonsense," Droy replied.
"That's not a river. That's torchlight. It looks like Olgod was right. These are the armies he used to tell us about. They've made it here after all."
Damn it! That was quick. Just as I thought things were working out. Orman cussed. Krim, who hadn't said a word yet, slammed his fist on a stone crenel. Droy opened his mouth to say something when we heard a powerful bugle call coming from the River of Fire.
"No way,"
Orman whispered, incredulous. The Kaltians looked at each other, their faces a complex mix of joy and disbelief. Their eyes were open wide, their nostrils flaring. Krim guffawed and slapped a sentry's shoulder. "Mind telling me what's going on?" I demanded. Droy lay his hand on my shoulder and squinted.
"The sound of this bugle means, my friend, that the Kaltians can't be killed so easily."
"Oh, no,"
Orman growled.
"This is Bad War the Thunder Warrior coming to pay us a visit."
"And he's not alone,"
Krim added.
"It looks like he's brought all of his stone fists with him."
We greeted the Stone Fists delegation outside, in the same place where we'd met Amay and his warriors only a few days ago. We made a large fire on the city border to serve as a beacon for their clan braving the darkness. I'd wondered if I should go on a recon flight, just to take a look at our new guests. Still, the others had talked me out of it. According to them, both Bad War and his men were probably at the end of their tethers. They might shoot me down first and ask questions later. Our little army walked out to meet them in full combat gear. According to Droy, we had to display our power to them. Bad War was a willful son of a bitch. He only understood the language of steel. We had to put on a good show, especially as we could afford it. Rank after rank of armor-clad warriors froze motionless around the fire. We didn't have to wait long. several figures emerged from the darkness at once.
"Shield wall!"
Droy bellowed. With the clatter of wood and clanging of steel, our warriors serried their ranks, which now bristled with spears. Then they froze again, awaiting our guests. They couldn't be very far, judging by the crunching of snow and the shadowy silhouettes gliding through the night.
"If that's not the Red Owls, you've changed a lot, haven't you?"
A rude, sarcastic voice called out of the dark.
"I can't believe it!"
The darkness parted, releasing a stocky figure wearing a round, masked helmet. A broad shield peeked from behind the warrior's back. He was holding an enormous axe.
"That's Badwar, the Thunder Warrior,"
Laosh told me under his breath. Two more warriors appeared next to him, one slightly taller and broader than his commander, the other a mere youngster next to those two. He was probably the armor-bearer of one of them.
"The big one is Gucker, the Black Serpent, from the White Lynx's clan."
Laosh resumed his running commentary.
"And the one next to him is Lavina the Vixen, the right hand of Bevan, who is the shaman with the Mountain Hawks."
His voice betrayed his surprise. Our ranks rustled with puzzled whispers. What could have baffled them so much? I very nearly asked Laosh as much when Droy addressed our visitors. I'd better wait and see what happens next.
"Badwar the Thunder Warrior, Gucker the Black Serpent, and Lavina the Vixen," Droy announced. "This is a surprise for me as well. The greatest warriors of our people have decided to honor us with their presence. I'm equally amazed seeing you here standing shoulder to shoulder."
Admittedly, our guests showed different reactions to his words. Badwar continued to smile, while Gucker stared impassively at the fire, as if Droy's words didn't concern him at all. Lavina, however, showed some signs of impatient anger, nodding her eyebrows and white-knuckling the short sword dangling from her belt.
"When we saw your torches from our city walls, we thought that a river of fire was flowing toward us," Droy continued. "But when I took another look, I realized that the river would have been much bigger had all the warriors whom your shamans had lured away been with you."
The steel wall of shields shifted as our warriors hummed their agreement.
"Our shamans are dead,"
the Black Serpent said. His voice indeed resembled a snake's hissing.
"I killed them all."
Laosh next to me, startled. A dead silence hung over the clearing, only disturbed by the crackling of the firewood and the bellowing of nearby buffaloes in the dark.
"Why are you still alive, then?"
Laosh shouted vindictively.
"Our ancient laws would have had you burned at the stake!"
Lavina stepped forward, inconspicuously shielding him with her shoulder. Had it not been for the gravity of the situation, it would have looked comical. A tiny female outline, lithe and slender, trying to protect this great oaf.
"We didn't burn him simply because he'd saved our lives," she shouted.
The tone of her voice, her angry face and clenched fists, I was pretty sure she'd have gladly added Laosh to the dead shaman list had she had half the chance. The face of the Black Serpent was impassive, his wide open eyes watching the play of the flames. He'd said what he'd had to say, and didn't care about the rest.
"We know the laws, old man,"
Badwar said conciliatorily.
"Then why did you disobey them?"
Laosh countered.
"Because your bodies, the showmans, deserve to die,"
Lavina spat out. Badwar lay his heavy hand on her shoulder.
"This is a good question, showman,"
he growled.
"But before answering it, I want to ask you something, too. All of you. Do you know how to perform the desolation ritual?"
The red owls grumbled their discontent. Someone in front of me cussed. I turned to Laosh. He was dark as a thundercloud. In the meantime, Badwar continued, peering into the faces of each of our warriors.
"Apparently you do. Now I'm gonna answer your question. It wasn't enough for them to have brought us to the Dark Fortress so that our best warriors lost their lives under its walls. Oh no! They also wanted to perform the desolation ritual. They wanted to sacrifice our women and children so that they could save their own worthless lives. So yes, they are dead. And if I could kill them all over again, I'd have gladly done so."
I didn't get much sleep that night. We had a council, Droy, Laosh, the sergeants, and myself, deciding what to do with all the refugees. Personally, I'd come to a decision a long time ago. As soon as I'd heard about Laosh leaving magic marks behind, I knew this was going to happen. So, had it been up to me, I would have gone to bed a long time ago. As it was, I had to preside over my clanmates playing the part of the Great Keeper of Twilight Castle, listening to their debating with each other. As far as the newcomers were concerned, they were the remains of the three strongest clans, which at the time had left their home valley and headed in the direction of the Dark Citadel. But if the Black Axe's shaman, seeing the complete defeat of their army, had wisely turned back, the shamans of the three other clans had decided to keep going. Those so-called generals had thought that a powerful magic attack on the citadel's defenses would allow the warriors to storm the walls and slaughter the defenders. So naive. Had it indeed worked out as planned, the players would have had a ball. Naturally, a powerful strike like that demanded a wealth of energy, which the shamans simply hadn't had. Still, they did have a solution. They could perform this so-called desolation ritual. As far as I gathered from Laosh's reluctant explanation, it was nothing more than a mass sacrifice which sucked energy out of living creatures. Laosh cringed when he spoke about it. I could see he would never have agreed to something like that. He'd much rather have sacrificed his own life to save his clanmates than killed them. I'd already witnessed that during our battle by the river.
"What were they thinking of?" he kept whispering. "Killing women and children! The future of their clans! And what for? They must have lost their minds! I know whose idea it was! It must have been Jodok, the leader of the Stone Fists, the great shaman, the strongest amongst us. That must have been his fault. He was toying with forbidden knowledge."
"And he paid the price,"
Orman growled. The others nodded.
"Yes.
Oh, yes, he did.
They're dead now, anyway,"
Droy summed up. He could say that, The game developers seem to be conspiring to strip my army of any magic support. First, it had been the Black Axe's shaman, so cleverly killed by Furious. Now it was Gucker who'd executed the remaining three. Granted, there was still a May roaming around the desert, but I'd had plenty of opportunity to realize that he was more harm than good. Besides, I wasn't at all sure if I'd ever see the Northern Wolves again. They knew the Noctian Horde was coming here. As long as we were battling them, they were unlikely to leave their steps. I couldn't say I blamed them.
"Which is why we need to take care of the living," Droy summed up.
He turned to Shore of the Hasty.
"How many did you count?"
"Almost 200 warriors," Shorv reported. "The rest are old men, women, and children."
I made a quick calculation. In total, that was about 500 new arrivals.
"Many of them are sick or injured," Shorv continued. "They told me they'd been constantly attacked on their way. Lots of monsters and Noctians around."
Droy turned to me.
"Do you think your magic could help them?"
The Red Owls already knew I was in possession of some magic that could heal them and make them stronger. I was pretty sure Laosh had something to do with it. He must have told his clanmates that the City Keeper was basically a healing artifact on two legs. I nodded. "It might. On one condition. You know it, don't you?"
"Yeah."
Droy kneaded his beard, thinking.
"In order to be healed, they need to join the clan."
I shrugged. "Sorry, but that's how it works. Alternatively, you can ask your wise women to help them. They've become much more skillful now, don't you think?"
"Thanks to you."
Krim gave me a friendly slap on the shoulder. He was right. Thanks to all the new recipes and materials, the clan's medicine women could now treat the simplest first and second degree injuries. Unfortunately, there were no monsters in No Man's Lands capable of dealing such minor damage. The smallest of the wounds they gave you were type blue. "So what do you think they're going to do now?" I asked the question which worried us all the most that night. Silence fell in the tent. I peered at my clanmates' faces, trying to second-guess what they were thinking. Seat frowned, biting his lower lip. Krim sat there, impassive, polishing his battle-axe blade with a leather cloth like he had nothing to do with any of it. Orman was studying his friends' faces, just like I was. A skeptical smile lurked on his lips. He must have already made up his mind. Now he was waiting to hear what his comrades had to say. Shorv was busy with a needle, mending a piece of gear. He was never idle, that one. Constantly busy doing something. He didn't seem to give a damn about the newcomer's fate. Aurum Redbeard was snoring away, his arms crossed on his chest. Ditto for Horm the Turtle. Droy was silent. I knew what he was thinking, anyway. I was curious about Laosh, though. What did he have to say? As if reading my thoughts, the old man spoke.
"One can't see the future in every detail. There are too many variables. What we can see, though, is our present. The way we use our present will decide our future."
Everybody nodded.
So what do we see in our present?
Laosh continued.
We see the remains of three clans, which used to be quite powerful.